Daniel chapter 11, verse 36 to the end. The king will do as he pleases. He will exalt and magnify himself above every god and will say unheard of things against the God of gods. He will be successful until the time of wrath is completed, for what has been determined must take place. He will show no regard for the gods of his ancestors or for the one desired by women, nor will he regard any god, but will exalt himself above them all. Instead of them, he will honour a god of fortresses, a god unknown to his ancestors. He will honour with gold and silver, with precious stones and costly gifts. He will attack the mightiest fortresses with the help of a foreign god, and will greatly honour those who acknowledge him. He will make them rulers over many people, and will distribute the land at a price. At the time of the end, the king of the south will engage him in battle, and the king of the north will storm out against him with chariots and cavalry and a great fleet of ships. He will invade many countries and sweep through them like a flood. He will also invade the beautiful land. Many countries will fall, but Edom, Moab, and the leaders of Ammon will be delivered from his hand. He will extend his power over many countries. Egypt will not escape. He will gain control of the treasures of gold and silver and all the riches of Egypt with the Libyans and the Cushites in submission. But reports from the east and the north will alarm him, and he will set out in a great rage to destroy and annihilate many. He will pitch his royal tents between the seas at the beautiful holy mountain, yet he will come to his end and no one will help him. At that time, Michael, the great prince who protects your people, will arise. There will be a time of distress, such as has not happened from the beginning of nations until then. But at that time, your people, everyone whose name is found written in the book, will be delivered. Multitudes who sleep in the dust of the earth will awake, some to everlasting life, others to shame and everlasting contempt. Those who are wise will shine like the brightness of the heavens, and those who lead many to righteousness like the stars forever and ever. But you, Daniel, roll up and seal the words of the scroll until the time of the end. Many will go here and there to increase knowledge. Then I, Daniel, looked, and there before me stood two others, one on his bank of the river and one on the opposite bank. One of them said to the man clothed in linen who was above the waters of the river, "How long will it be before these astonishing things are fulfilled?" The man clothed in linen who was above the waters of the river lifted up his right hand and his left hand toward heaven, and I heard him swear by him who lives forever, saying, "It will be for a time, times and half a time, when the power of the holy people has been finally broken, all these things will be completed." I heard, but I did not understand. So I asked, "My Lord, what will the outcome of all this be?" He replied, "Go your way, Daniel, because the words are rolled up and sealed until the end, till the time of the end. Many will be purified, made spotless and refined, but the wicked will continue to be wicked. None of the wicked will understand, but those who are wise will understand. From the time that the daily sacrifice is abolished and the abomination that causes desolation is set up, there will be 1,290 days. Blessed is the one who waits for and reaches the end of the 1,335 days. As for you, go your way till the end. You will rest, and then at the end of the days, you will rise to receive your allotted inheritance."
Thanks, Alice. He's a real nowhere man, sitting in his nowhere land, making all his nowhere plans for nobody. Doesn't have a point of view, knows not where he's going to. Isn't he a bit like you and me? Song, 1965, Rubber Soul album, penned by John Lennon, at the height of the Beatles' fame. He told Paul McCartney that It was a song about himself, but John Lennon expresses his philosophy on life. Life has no destination. It's not going anywhere. And therefore, no meaning. And if that's what we think, then we won't know how to fill our days here on earth. So imagine I say to you, I'm taking you on an all-expenses trip of a lifetime tomorrow. Get packing now. What do you pack? Is it stuff for the beach? Is it stuff for the mountains? Hard to know, because I've not told you where we're going. Destination determines what you fill your suitcase with. But you don't know the destination. So you just pack everything. You put in the ski boots, you put in the walking boots, you put in the sandals, you put in the snowsuit, you put in the swimsuit, you put in the dinner suit. You just don't know what to take. You just put everything in. And that's life for many people. We think the universe is silent on our destination, so we don't know what to fill our lives and our days with, and we just pack everything. So we put in extra long hours at work. We're packing for that promotion. We put in long hours in the library because we're packing for that first-class degree. We put in the long miles on the road because we're packing for that personal best in the half marathon. And then we spend our evenings at parties or on the dating website because we're packing for romance, or we spend our evenings binging on Netflix because we're packing for entertainment. We move to a bigger house because everyone else we know seems to be doing that. On our holidays, we go white water rafting because we're packing for adventure. And in between, we take up ballroom dancing, and we take up judo, and we take up Pilates, and we take up that French class. And none of it really satisfies, because we don't know where we're going. We're not sure that all this stuff is the right stuff to be filling our days with, because we don't know where we're going. So we're just packing for packing's sake. And when we're packing for packing's sake, the novelty of packing soon wears off. But the universe isn't silent. That's the good news. God has spoken into this world, and we've got his word in front of us now. And he tells us so clearly that history isn't going nowhere, it's going somewhere. It's heading to its destination. The world is under control. It's firmly in the hands of the God who made it. That's the message of Daniel. Reveals who God is. He's the God who reveals. He knows the future. He's the God who rules. He's in control of it. And he's directing everything that happens today towards his desired destinations, to the fulfillment of his good purposes. God who reveals, rules, and he's the God who rescues. He rescues his people, and he keeps his people for the future that he's prepared for them. God wins. That's the message of the book of Daniel. Jesus wins. That's where history is heading. The world is going to end in victory for God and victory for his King, Jesus. And knowing that that's where everything is going means knowing what to fill our lives and our days with now. So remember Daniel's... God's people, they've been captured, and Jerusalem has been trashed, temple's been destroyed, they've been taken captive and shipped off to Babylon, where they're in exile, and their question in Babylon is, where is the Lord? It looks like Babylon and its kings and its gods are greater than the Lord. It looks like Babylon wins. But the message of Daniel is, don't be fooled by how things look. The Lord wins. And he will defeat evil, and he will set his people free, and he will take them home to Jerusalem. And in the second half of the book of Daniel, we've got these series of visions that we've been looking at in recent months, showing future history beyond the exile in Babylon, beyond the return to Jerusalem. And these final chapters, 10 to 12, are the final vision given to Daniel, given by this glorious heavenly person. That's who he sees, this man in linen, who I think is very clear is this pre-incarnate Son of God, pre-incarnate Jesus before he comes to earth. And he tells Daniel how history is going to end. But he also tells Daniel how history is going to go on the way to the end, what God's people can expect. And it's this, it's going to be tough. It's going to be tough for God's people. It's going to be very tough. It's going to be marked by distress if you're one of God's people. And chapter 11, we saw, looks ahead to the rise and the fall of Persia and to the rise and fall of Alexander the Great, and to these ongoing battles for a couple of centuries between the kings of Syria in the north and the kings of Egypt in the south, and God's people in Jerusalem stuck in the middle, suffering because of all these armies trample over them. And then Daniel 11 reveals a monster, the rise of a monster, a terrible monster, a brutal tyrant who will outlaw the worship of God and do everything within his power to destroy the people of God. Antiochus Epiphanes IV, history proved that man to be. But he will fail, Daniel 11 says. He will fall. And he did. And we saw that when we looked at Daniel 8. But Daniel 11 says that's not going to be the end of the distress. It's going to get worse for God's people. And so we come to the king who does as he pleases, the king who exalts himself at the end of chapter 11. And in these final verses, we learn how history goes. How history goes, the way it goes. And it's the way of distress for God's people. Verses 36 to 39, they fit with the kind of things that Antiochus Epiphanes IV did in the 2nd century BC. But from verse 40 onwards, the verses there don't match up with any event that we know in the reign of Antiochus. And that suggests that these verses are dealing with something just a little bit different. The passage is very rich, actually, in Old Testament language. And this suggests that what we have here is not referring to a particular event, but giving us just a big picture of what life is going to be like for God's people in this world. And what we can expect and how things are going to appear until the end. So you see in verse 40, it's a picture of evil seeming to succeed greatly. This king just invades everywhere with his armies. Great success, seemingly, of evil. It's a picture of believers being attacked and unbelievers being rescued. So you've got the traditional enemies of Israel there. You've got Edom and Moab and Ammon. And they seem to be saved, rescued from evil. Everyone seems to be under the control of this evil king, verses 42 and 43, and just as it looks as if he's going to storm God's holy mountain, God's place, and finish off God's people, just as it looks as if God has lost and evil has won, the evil is finished, with no one to help him, verse 45. In other words, the pattern that Antiochus set is going to continue. It's going to continue through history. He's just the curtain raiser for more of the same to come until the end. Anti-God kings rising up, venting their fury against God and against God's people. It's the way history is going to go. So often it looks like evil is winning and that God is losing. Looks like his people are losing. That's how it looks. And then all of a sudden, bang, with one moment of God's appointed time, all the evil comes to the end. He's done it before, he's done it regularly, he's going to do it again. Chapter 12, verse 1, at that time, Michael, the great prince who protects your people, will arise. There will be a time of distress, such as not happened from the beginning of nations until then. Met Michael already in this Daniel series, he's an archangel, protector of God's people. He will arise. When will that be? Bible tells us. Just remember, the Bible interprets the Bible. Where else in the Bible do we read of Michael? One other place. Two other places, Jude, but the main place is Revelation 12. Revelation 12, where we read there's a great war in the heavenly realms. And there's this fight between Michael and his angels and the dragon, who's the devil, Satan, and his angels. And the devil isn't strong enough. And he's defeated and he's hurled out of heaven, down to the earth. That's when Michael arises. In Daniel's day, the throwing down of the devil by Michael lay in the future. In our day, the throwing down of the devil by Michael lies in the past. Revelation chapter 12 makes it very clear that Satan's downfall, his throwing down to the earth, happened the moment when Jesus died on the cross. As Jesus breaks the power of sin on the cross, he breaks the power of Satan to accuse us. Satan is expelled from heaven by Michael. And it's all because of the work that Jesus did on the cross. And Revelation chapter 12 reminds us that from that time on, from the time of Jesus' victory on the cross, it's going to mean greater troubles for God's people. Because the devil, full of fury, raging against God's people, he knows that his time is short, knows he's defeated, knows he's finished. And that's what Daniel 12, verse 1 is warning us of. From the time of Jesus' victory on the cross to the time of his second coming, there's going to be a time of distress such as never happened before in the history of the world. It's this period that the Bible calls the last days, from Jesus' resurrection to the day of his return. It's the last days, it's the end. And it's going to be a time of distress. Distress for God's people. But only for a while. History from Jesus' day to the end is going to be full of people like Antiochus Epiphanes. Anti-God, anti-Christ. That's how it's been for the past 2,000 years, isn't it? You look at history. I mean, you can have this list that's so, so long. Here's just a few Antiochus types. Nero, Roman Emperor. In this country, Queen Mary, Bloody Mary. Hitler, Stalin, Chairman Mao, Pol Pot, Idi Amin in the last century. The list goes on and on and on, right up to today and the brutal tyrant in North Korea, Kim Jong-un. Many others, people bent on stamping out the worship of God, bent on destroying the people of God. And that's how it's going to be to the very end. And in his vision, Daniel sees two other people, two angelic witnesses, and one of them asked the man in linen, how long will it be before these astonishing things are fulfilled? Verse 6. How long is it going to last, this distress? And back comes the enigmatic answer, for a time, times, and half a time. Strange. But again, the Bible tells us about that. That same phrase is picked up in Revelation to symbolize, to picture the entire period between the first coming and the second coming of Jesus. 3.5 years. A year, 2 years, half a year. 3.5 years. Or it's also symbolized as 42 months, exactly the same time period. Or 1,260 days. All of that the same. 3.5 years. How long will the distress last? In other words, right to the end. But it's not forever. Remember numbers in the Bible, symbolic, in these books of Daniel and Revelation. What's the number of perfection in the Bible? Of completeness? 7. The distress isn't for 7 years. It's not going to last forever. It's half of 7. 3.5. It won't last forever. Now, some of you will be scratching your heads thinking, well, what about those other numbers? What about, you know, the 1,290 days in verse 11 and the 1,335 days in verse 12? They're more than 3.5 years. They're more than the 1,260 days. They're small additions to it. What do they mean? Well, no one knows for sure. And if you're inclined to do that kind of thing, you can look in the commentaries and you can read ream and ream and ream. And end of the day, no one knows for sure. Here's my guess. Verse 11 starts the count from Antiochus's blasphemy, the abomination that causes desolation. So for believers in that time, which was 167 BC, 2 centuries before Jesus, for believers in that time, the wait until the end is a little longer than the 3.5 years. And then for Daniel and believers in his day, which was 537 BC, it's going to be a little longer still. 1,335 days. Well, that's one possibility. But no one knows for sure. And sometimes we just have to admit we don't know. But what we do know, these are symbolic numbers. What we do know is that the time of suffering is limited. It's got a shelf life. That's what these numbers are. They're God's way of reminding his people that he's in control of everything, and he's even in control of the suffering, and he's in control to the end. And it will come to an end, the suffering. It is temporary, the distress. On the way, it's got a purpose. We've seen that this purpose is the refining, the purifying of God's people, making them more like Jesus, but it's temporary. And these numbers tell us that God has a people who will make it to the end, in spite of everything that's thrown at them. So they're a comfort and an encouragement. But when you're in the thick of it, when you're in that distress, it will feel like a long time. And you will wonder if evil has won and God has lost. But remember the pattern. Look at the history of God's people. At the moment, it looks as if all is lost, all is won. At that very moment, remember God's people at the Red Sea, trapped with the might of the Egyptian army, bearing down on them, nowhere to go, all looks lost. But then all of a sudden, bang, God parts the sea, people go through, God brings the sea back, Pharaoh and his army are drowned, God leads his people to the promised land. Remember the exile, remember Jerusalem destroyed, God's people taken captive, looks like all is lost, Babylon has won, evil has triumphed. But no, in just one night, Daniel 5, God brings the Babylonians down, replaces them with the Persians, who allow the people to go home to Jerusalem. God leads his people home. And especially, as we're going to do in a few moments, especially we remember Jesus. Remember God's Messiah, killed by evil men on a cross. At that moment, all looked lost. All looked finished when Jesus said, "It is finished." And it was, but not for Jesus. For Satan and all the powers of darkness. Victory for Jesus. Resurrection for Jesus. At the moment, all looked lost. All is won. Distress is followed by deliverance. The cross is followed by the crown. That's how it was for Jesus. That's how it was for the head. That's how it will be for his body, the church. And the church has been trampled down the ages, threatened with extinction at various times, but it's continued to rise again. And we can give many examples. We haven't got time. Just think of China in the last century. Expulsion of all the missionaries from China, a terrible persecution, Chinese believers incarcerated in indoctrination camps, all looked over for Christianity in China. The cry went out in Shanghai, Christianity is dead in China. All looked lost, but all is won. Because when people start to go back decades later, we see that the church has risen. There'll be times, until the end, there'll be times of great distress when the church looks defeated, completely broken even, dead, buried. That's the way history will go. But when it looks as if all is lost, Jesus will return. The end will come, and deliverance will come. Great distress, but not forever. Great deliverance will come. So that's the way history will go, and we come to the way history's going to end. Verse 1 of chapter 12, but at that time your people, everyone whose name is found written in the book, will be delivered. Multitudes who sleep in the dust of the earth will awake, some to everlasting life, others to shame and everlasting contempt. Those who are wise will shine like the brightness of the heavens, and those who lead many to righteousness like the stars forever and ever. That's where history's headed, Resurrection Day. The day that Jesus returns to judge the living and the dead. Death is not the end for anyone. You see that? It's not the end for anyone. Everyone will rise to an everlasting future, either to everlasting life or to everlasting contempt and shame. There are only two futures. Both are forever. Everyone who has ever lived will spend forever in one of those two places. One is unspeakably horrible. The other future is unspeakably wonderful. Horrible future for all those who have lived for the kingdom of this world, for all those who've lived for the kingdom of self, for all those people who've refused Jesus' rule and Jesus' rescue in this life. There's a horrible future of everlasting shame and contempt in the next. Jesus, the pre-incarnate Jesus, is warning his people here in the Old Testament. When he becomes a man and comes to earth, he does exactly the same. If you read the Gospels and you listen to his preaching, no one spoke more about this horrible future than Jesus. And that's because Jesus is love. And love warns those it loves. And Jesus is always warning people. Again and again of this horrific future. He calls it hell. And that's the horrible future. And then there's the wonderful future for God's people, for those who've lived for his kingdom, those who've received his rescue and embraced his rule and have followed him. There's a wonderful future described as shining like the brightness of the heavens and like the stars forever and ever. Glory described at the end of the chapter as allotted inheritance. It's a bright future, it's a brilliant future, it's everlasting life. Not just an extension of this life, not just an afterlife, that's what we tend to call it, afterlife. Gives us the wrong impression as if it's just this life is the main event and what comes is just tacked on to this one. No. The next life is deliverance from this life. The next life is deliverance from the distress of this life. Everything that is bad and sad and painful about this world will be gone for good. Sin will be gone, suffering will be gone, sadness will be gone, Satan will be gone, death will be gone. And we're given glimpses of that perfect world in lots of different parts of the Bible. And what we see is glorious. It is our decaying bodies transformed into glorious resurrection, indestructible bodies. And a great feast and a great party. Forget the comedy views of heaven. We've kind of drunk them in from our culture. The comedy views of heaven, fluffy land, cloud land, Laura Ashley nightdress land. Forget that. Think inheritance. Who are we, God's children? What will we inherit? All our Father's riches. Everything that by rights belongs to his Son Jesus is ours. A new universe, whole new universe. It's Jesus to rule over, and he will share it with those that he has rescued into the family. That's our allotted inheritance, allotted to us, and no one and nothing can take it away from us. It's an inheritance, as we read from that verse in Peter at the start of our time, it's an inheritance that can never perish, spoil, or fade. Solid. Now, we tend to think that it's the other way around. We tend to think that this is the solid world, and the next world is the flimsy world. But it's the other way around. The Bible shows us so clearly this is the flimsy world. Our experience tells us this is the flimsy world. Nothing lasts here. Our health doesn't last. Our youth doesn't last. Our eyesight doesn't last. Our hearing doesn't last. Our friendships don't last. They fade, they wither, they vanish all too soon. Flimsy world. But our inheritance, life in the new world, is the exact opposite of that. It won't decay, it won't decline, it won't fade. It can't be stolen, can't be ended by a bad tackle on the football pitch, can't be sacked from it, you can't be divorced from it. It won't end in death. And knowing that the distress is temporary and will be finished one day, and that the deliverance is coming and it's forever, that helps us to cope with the pain and the distress now. And Jesus is the greatest example of this. No one experienced the distress that Jesus experienced. How could he cope with the distress and the agony of the cross? He knew a great deliverance was coming. He knew he would be raised, and he knew that that meant that his people would be raised too. And so for the joy set before him, Hebrews 12, he endured the shame of the cross. It's an amazing thing when we see people trusting Jesus and living for the future in the middle of great distress. Have you ever seen that? Have you ever seen people doing that? People saw it in Dietrich Bonhoeffer, German pastor, killed by the Nazis because he stood against Hitler, he stood against the Nazis. They killed him just before the end of the Second World War, April 1945. He was just 39 years old. People since then have seen his death as a tragic thing. He would never have seen it like that. If you read his sermons and you read his books, he described death as the last station on the road to freedom. He was a man who was looking forward to resurrection. He described himself as homesick for the world of resurrection. He lived in the light of that. That's why he walked very calmly and very courageously and very cheerfully in those days of distress for the church in Germany. And that's why when those evil-looking men came into his prison cell, he turned to his friend, Payne Best, and said, "This is the end. But for me, the beginning of life." The camp doctor, prison camp doctor, witnessed Dietrich Bonhoeffer's final few minutes before his execution. Bonhoeffer was praying, and this is what the doctor said. He says, "I was deeply moved by the way this lovable man prayed, so devout and so certain that God heard his prayer. And he climbed the steps to the gallows, brave and composed. I've hardly seen a man so entirely submissive to the will of God. He, knowing the distress is temporary and the deliverance is forever, makes a difference to today. Yes, the way that history goes is one of distress, but the way history ends is one of deliverance. And that makes a difference to the way we live now. And that brings us to our final point, the way the wise live now. How are we going to live now in the light of that? Just as there are only two destinations and two destinies, there are only two groups of people in this world at the end of the day, only two groups of people. There are the wise, verse 3, and the wicked, verse 10. Being wise in the Bible doesn't mean being clever, doesn't mean being intelligent. Being wise means knowing God and trusting Him. Proverbs 9, verse 10 says, "The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom." Being wise means knowing God. Being wise means living for Him. It means living today in the light of forever. And knowing where everything is going changes how we look at now and how we live for now. Determines what we put in the suitcase. Kind of gets you thinking, doesn't it? Who cares about what clothes we wear and the kind of holidays we go on? Who cares what car you drive and what house you live in? Who cares what school you go to, what university you go to or don't go to? It's all temporary. And the wise will want to get ready for forever, for the things that are everlasting. And being ready for that day is very, very simple. Being ready means trusting and then keeping trusting. Trusting and persevering. Trusting. Verses 1 and 2, chapter 12. Notice only those whose names are written in the book will be delivered from the terrible judgment to come. Elsewhere in the Bible, the book is called the Book of Life, or the book, or the Lamb's Book of Life. In other words, it's a list of Jesus' people. It's a list of everyone who trusts in Jesus and his death for them. And on that day, that final day, we need one thing and only one thing. We don't need to pass exam. We don't need to go through a religious ritual. We don't need to go on a pilgrimage. We need our name to be written in the Book of Life. We need faith in Jesus Christ, the Lamb who loved us so much that he took the shame and he took the contempt that we deserve in our place so that we can live with him forever. That's the most important thing. Trust in Jesus. We can never make it on our own. He's done everything for us. The only way we can be safe on that day is by trusting in Jesus and trusting our life into his hands. And if you haven't done that yet, will you consider doing it today? You're on a journey. You're going somewhere. And without Jesus, you're going to everlasting shame and everlasting contempt. Stop today. Change direction. Change destiny. Change sides. Receive Jesus. Join his kingdom. And you will have a very different future. Once we've done that, and if we've done that, and if we've done that, the next most important thing after we've entrusted our life to Jesus is keep trusting Jesus. Keep following him to the end. Trusting him means obeying him. Trusting him means following him. Persevere. Twice Daniel's told in this final chapter, did you see it? Go your way. Go your way, Daniel. Go your way till the end. Just go on as you are. What have we seen of Daniel? How's he been going? Trusting God. Obeying God in a hostile world. Shining for God now. He's going to shine for him forever. Shine for God now. That's when the shining starts. Serving God, where he's put you, Daniel, in that Persian court, in the civil service of the Persian emperor. You keep serving God there. Keep standing for him. Keep pointing others to him. Keep praying to him for others. That's what we've seen Daniel doing in this book. And he needs to keep doing it. Live now in the light of the future. And that's the way that we're to go to. That's how we're to fill our days and to fill our lives. So suppose I eventually get round to telling you where we're going on our trip tomorrow. Bahamas. The tropics. That's where we're off. And you're tempted to slip in some ski boots and a ski suit. And then you think, well, no, what am I doing? Am I crazy? I'm going to Bahamas. It's not a place for ski boots. It's not a place for ski suits. crazy to pack them. God says to us, you're going to the paradise, my new creation. So, if we are thinking of packing some cruel gossip into our day later today, we need to think again. If we're thinking of packing some late-night lust as we travel through this coming week, or a bit of boastfulness, or a bit of self-righteousness, we've got to think again. Remember where we're going. New creation. Those things belong to the kingdom of this world. They don't belong in God's kingdom. No use for them there. So we pull them out of our luggage now. We're packing for paradise, where everything is good, and everything is lovely, everything's true. Knowing where we're going changes everything. Now, of course, we can enjoy the good things that God gives. Of course we can. There's nothing wrong with pursuing a career and an education and holidays and French classes and Pilates and what else did we say? Ballroom dancing. Nothing wrong with those things. We enjoy the good things that God gives, but we don't become obsessed with them. We don't elevate them to a status they're not meant to have. We don't become obsessed with money. We don't become obsessed with education, career, partying, sport. We use all those things to make God known, to lead others to righteousness, as it says in verse 3. That's what it's about. Make Jesus known. We use these things to serve him, not ourselves. But forget being rich. Forget being successful. Forget being famous. They don't last. They're way too small. We've got to dream bigger. Dream of ways of serving God's kingdom, because God's kingdom is big and it's forever. So if you're a hairdresser, I had my hair cut on Friday, I was just thinking this. If you're a hairdresser, if you're good at hairdressing, cut hair for Jesus. You're going to meet loads of people doing that. Captive audience. Bring honor to Jesus by doing your job well, by listening well, by being empathetic, being kind, and when you've got the chance, sharing your hope in Christ. If you're good at fixing cars, do it for Jesus. If you're gifted at business and making money, well, make money for Jesus. Make money for Jesus. Use the money you make for God's kingdom. I mean, you could help plant a church in Shap, in Cumbria. How exciting is that? If you're a farmer, you're good at farming, you love farming, farm for Jesus. Whatever it is, just work it out. It's very simple. Knowing the way that we're going means living wisely now, going God's way. But it won't be easy. Standing for Jesus will mean trouble for us of one kind or another. And we will face pressure to give up on God's kingdom and to invest everything in the here and now. Don't do it. Don't give up. Remember verse 13. Remember how Daniel ends. Let's have a look at it. It's a wonderful promise. Hear the promise and keep going. As for you, go your way till the end. You will rest, and at the end of the days, you'll rise to receive your allotted inheritance. And when you've walked through the life of a difficult and distressing world to the end of your life here, it won't be the end. You'll rest. And you can write rest in peace on your gravestone, because you will rest. You'll rest in peace. You'll rest in Christ. But then you will rise in power. Rest in peace. You'll rise in power, rise in glory. And the end for you will only be the beginning. I love the way C.S. Lewis describes the wonder and glory of the new creation at the end of the Narnia stories. And I've shared this before. I can't think of a better way of describing it outside of the Bible. The things that began to happen to them after that were so great and so beautiful that I can't write them. And for us, this is the end of all the stories, all the Narnia stories, and we can most truly say that they all lived happily ever after. But for them, it wasn't the end. It was only the beginning of the real story. All their life in this world and all their adventures in Narnia had only been the cover and the title page. Now at last, they were beginning chapter one of the great story, which no one on earth has ever read, which goes on forever, and in which every chapter is better than the one before. That's what it's going to be like. That's where we're going. We're going somewhere to that glorious future. It's going to be wonderful. Don't give up. Keep going. Keep going. It's worth it.